Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. There were a number of U.S. presidents who concealed illnesses, and some of their illnesses were quite serious. President Washington had a very, very serious bout with influenza. President Abraham Lincoln had smallpox, and it took him more than a month to recover from that. Chester Arthur had a kidney ailment. Woodrow Wilson, of course, had a very severe stroke, and his wife, Edith Wilson, oversaw the executive branch after her husband's stroke. Warren Harding had an extremely weak heart. James Garfield didn't die from the gunshot that he received, but from receiving really bad health care. And, of course, we know in more recent times about the serious illnesses of President John Kennedy. Well, our guest this hour has chosen to concentrate on a fascinating time in American history and a fascinating case of a president who was seriously ill and was taken off on a yacht to have an operation performed that was risky. And it's amazing it took place on a yacht and nobody knew what was going on. Our guest, Matthew Algio, is the author of The President is a Sick Man, wherein the supposedly virtuous Grover Cleveland survives a secret surgery at sea and vilifies the courageous newspaper man who dared expose the truth. Matthew is a public radio reporter. He was with us a little over a year and a half ago when he talked about Harry Truman's excellent adventure, The True Story of a Great American Road Trip, which is a wonderful read. He's also the author of Last Team Standing, How the Steelers and the Eagles, the Steagles, Saved Pro Football During World War II. He's joining us by phone from, I love to say this, because who do you interview who's in this location? He's joining us by phone from Mongolia, where he lives. His wife is working with a foreign service, I believe, and so that's why they are where they are. Hello. To you,
Hi,
Matthew. Kathy. Hi. I love this book. This is just absolutely fascinating. Who would have thought Grover Cleveland had this incident and that his presidency was so fascinating? I just hadn't thought very much about him. And this, it's got newspapers, it's got, you know, rich people and poor people and socialism and strikes and Eugene Debs and a guy who's old who has children when he's very old. And it's just got everything, doesn't it?
Thank you. Yeah, it was a really interesting story. And Grover has always sort of been one of my favorite presidents.
Really?
Because of the whole, the two non-consecutive terms. I mean, that's what everybody knows Grover for. He was the 22nd and 24th presidents. He's the one that screws up the numbering because he lost re-election in 1888 and ran for re-election, or ran for a again, 4 years later in 1892 and won the White House back. And I always thought, well, this is kind of an amazing thing. I mean, how many, it's unique.
It's
a unique achievement in American political history. And so he must have been an amazing politician. And I'd always kind of known about this story about, how he had this secret operation on a boat. And it was about 10 years ago, I went to a museum in Philadelphia called the Mutter Museum, and they actually have the tumor that was removed from Grover Cleveland during this secret operation on the boat. They have it on display there, and that's what kind of got me thinking about the story and looking more into it and looking more into Grover Cleveland. And as you said, as you kind of peeled back the layers, there were a lot of different stories in there. It was about politics and medicine and economics and journalism, all kinds of things that were going on in the 1890s. So it really turned out to be, I think, a pretty interesting story.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story. There's just so much to the time period. And the country was going through such incredibly difficult times as well.
Yeah, it was really cool, too, because it was a gap in my knowledge of American history. I mean, I'm not a historian by training by any means. I just, mostly what I know about history I learned from Jeopardy, but I knew a lot about the Civil War, and I'm pretty good on World War II and even World War I, but this time between the Civil War and World War I, the Gilded Age, I really didn't know a lot about, and so it was a good chance for me to kind of go and learn that for the first time, and there were so many things going on that really resonate today. One of the problems and one of the reasons that Cleveland wanted to keep his cancer secret was that the economy was in a terrible recession, actually became a terrible depression, And this was really prompted by a speculative bubble in 1893. And in 1893, the bubble was railroads. Of course, we've had more recent bubbles with real estate and dot-com, but in 1893, it was railroads, and that really is what sent the stock markets crashing in 1893. So you see this time and again, so many things that were similar to today, and it was really fascinating to research that and to learn that.
There was also a memory, and tell me how strong it was, of Ulysses Grant's death, which was reported on, and which was excruciatingly painful, of cancer.
Yeah, what happened, and just sort of to just kind of set the stage, it was shortly after Cleveland took office for the second time in 1893. He noticed a bump on the roof of his mouth. It was diagnosed as cancer. He agreed to have this tumor removed, but only if the operation was kept secret, and he decided to do the operation on a friend's yacht. So they were sailing from New York to Massachusetts, and it was while they were sailing that he had the operation. But one of the reasons that he wanted to keep the operation secret is that at the time, cancer really had a stigma attached to it. Even newspapers wouldn't use the word cancer. They'd call it the dread disease or the disease that no doctor dare name, these sorts of things. And one of the reasons it had the stigma was, as you mentioned, about 10 years before, about 1884, Ulysses S. Grant had died of an oral cancer, and the newspapers covered this relentlessly. It was really kind of the first time in American history that what we would consider a celebrity, that a celebrity death was covered like this. I mean, it was morbid in a way. All the reporters just hung out outside Grant's townhouse in New York, kind of waiting for him to die. And Cleveland was really a private guy, and he had no desire to be the object of that kind of spectacle, like Grant was when he died. And so that was one of the reasons he decided to keep his cancer secret.
Did you think, as you were looking at his earlier life and the amount of time he spent at saloons, the amount of time he spent at the breakfast, lunch, and dinner table, that his pretty bad habits were going to catch up with him? And this guy was huge.
He was the second biggest president after Taft. Cleveland was about 250 to 300 pounds in the second term, for sure, at the beginning of his second term. And, yeah, he did. He had a very unhealthy lifestyle.
Right.
He moved to Buffalo when he was in his teens, and Buffalo at that time was a real boom town. The canal had just been completed, and it was really one of the great boom towns in American history. And Cleveland really drank all that in. I mean, he would go down to the saloons. He never cooked a meal. He always took his meals in boarding houses or restaurants or saloons. And when he was elected president, he was still a bachelor. And so he had lived this lifestyle for 40 years. He smoked cigars and drank a lot of beer. He especially loved German food. So, you know, going back and trying to do the, you know, I guess like reverse pathology or whatever you would call it, it's pretty easy in Cleveland's case, because he lived the unhealthy lifestyle. He was bound to get something or other.
And tell me some of those other early stories. I think the other thing that we remember him for, and I'm thankful for your book because we'll remember him for much more now, but this fathering an illegitimate child, that's a fascinating story.
Yeah. Cleveland, this was actually his first campaign for the presidency in 1884, and it's interesting to know. One of the things that really fascinated me about Cleveland was going back and studying him, and we talked about the non-consecutive terms. Of course, everybody remembers that. But he really rose to the presidency from obscurity probably faster than anybody else in American political history.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in 1880, nobody had ever heard of Grover Cleveland. In 1881, the Democrats were looking for somebody to run for mayor in Buffalo, and really the only reason they chose Cleveland is because he was single. And so he could afford to take the pay cut that came with the job. Everybody else had families. And so Cleveland was nominated in 1881 to be the Democratic candidate for mayor of Buffalo. He won. He established himself really as this kind of a reformist. He was known as the veto mayor. He vetoed so many wasteful spending bills. And the following year, 1882, he was elected governor of New York. And 2 years later, 1884, he was elected president. So in 4 years, he went from somebody nobody had ever heard of to president. And it was during this campaign in 1884 that it came out that he had fathered an illegitimate child. Now, he never really explicitly admitted that he was the father of the child, but he did admit that he cared for the child, And when the story broke, he sent a telegram to his friends back in Buffalo, and it said simply, "Tell the truth." And this really established Cleveland's reputation for honesty and for integrity that would really come to serve him well down the line, especially when he wanted to cover up this operation he had for cancer. But it's interesting, really, his response to the scandal probably earned him more votes than the scandal itself cost him, if that makes any sense. I mean, people really respected how forthright he was when this accusation came out, and in some weird way, it kind of benefited him. And his honest reaction to the revelation really endeared him in a way to voters and proved him to be an honest man and helped him win the presidency in 1884.
It's even more amazing, isn't it, Matthew, if, as the story may indicate, he really wasn't the father of the child, but his best friend, who subsequently died, didn't he, in a tragic accident,
right,
may have been the father of the child.
Right.
And he decided to take the rap for it.
That is one of the theories, is that, and the child was named Oscar Folsom Cleveland, and Oscar Folsom was Grover's friend and law partner. And so one of the theories holds that Oscar Folsom, Grover's friend and law partner, was actually the father of the child, but Oscar was married and had a family of his own. And so to spare Oscar this scandal, Grover, who was still a bachelor at the time, he decided to accept responsibility for the child, to spare his friend Oscar the shame that would come with having fathered this child out of wedlock. And so,
quite a story.
That's one of the theories. I guess, if the child had any descendants, we could probably clear this up, you know, with a DNA test pretty easily, but we haven't yet.
And then he winds up, isn't this the way the story goes? He winds up marrying Oscar's daughter.
What happened was Oscar died in a carriage accident. This is Grover's friend and law partner. And Oscar had a small child at the time. I think it was like 2 or 3 years old she was, the daughter, Frances. And so Grover kind of became Frances' guardian, not legally, but really, I mean, Grover looked after Frances as she grew up as the daughter of his late law partner. And 2 years after Grover became president in 1886, he ended up marrying this girl, Frances. At the time, she was 21 and he was 49.
Wow.
And so what happened was when she went off to college, to put it, delicately, their relationship blossomed into something more serious than it had been before. And so Grover ended up marrying Frances in 1886. And she is the youngest first lady in American history. She was 21 years old when she married Grover in 1886. And I would say that's probably a record unlikely to be broken anytime soon.
Yeah, I would imagine. All right, let's go back to the story of going on this yacht.
Okay.
And having this surgery done. He didn't. It's amazing to me. This is a fairly serious thing that he may be getting into. I mean, who knows? He might lose part of his face. He might have spread to other parts of his body. And it is so secretive that he doesn't even inform Adlai Stevenson, his vice president.
Yeah. This is one of the interesting things, too. There was a great debate in the country at that time, and it was over currency, and specifically, should our currency be backed by gold, or should it be backed by gold and silver? Which metal should our currency be backed by, which, of course, this debate seems very arcane to us.
Yes.
Today, when our currency is firmly backed by nothing, but... In 1893, the choice was either gold or silver. And what happened was Cleveland, when he ran for his second term in 1892, he at the Democratic convention, his running mate was sort of was picked for him, and his running mate was Adlai Stevenson, as he mentioned, the grandfather of the future presidential candidate. And Stevenson was a silver guy. Cleveland was a gold guy. Cleveland believed in the gold standard. But Stevenson was a silver guy. He was from Illinois, which at that time was considered the West. And so he was kind of added to the ticket to hopefully win some Western and Southern states where silver was really the, that were pro-silver. And it worked. Cleveland ended up winning the election in 1892, of course. But the problem was the president and the vice president were on exact opposite sides of the most contentious political issue of the age. And so you had this weird situation where Cleveland and Stevenson, I mean, were kind enough to each other. They were considerate to each other, but really were on opposite sides of the major political issue. And so when Cleveland found out he had cancer, he was especially adamant that Stevenson, his vice president, not know. Cleveland was a gold guy, so he was afraid that Stevenson, as a silver guy, would kind of step in and advance the cause for silver. And so when Cleveland found out he had cancer, he actually sent Stevenson on a political trip to Seattle in 1893, which was a rather arduous trip. And that really got Stevenson out of the picture for about 4 weeks, which was enough time for Cleveland to go and have this operation, and Stevenson never find anything out about it.
Can you imagine what would have happened if the operation had not gone as planned? And he had become president, Stevenson?
And it's funny because Grover was really a very pragmatic guy. It was uncharacteristic. So much about this story was uncharacteristic of Cleveland. First of all, from the standpoint of his honesty, he had carefully cultivated this reputation for honesty. And basically, he had built all this political capital and spent it on this big lie to make the public believe he wasn't ill when he really was ill. And also to keep Stevenson out of the loop. I mean, it was foolhardy, really.
Yes.
Stevenson would have been completely unprepared to be president if anything had happened to Cleveland. And the fact that the doctors, there were six doctors recruited to perform this operation on the boat to remove the tumor from his mouth, that they would agree to do it was kind of insane. They were all putting their careers at risk. Cleveland, the doctors, everybody. It's really kind of amazing that, A, they decided to do it, to go ahead, and B, that they managed to pull it off. It's just, it's astounding.
Hmm. The other thing that's fascinating about this time and this particular incident is you outline and you inform us what happened to the doctors afterward, who spoke, who didn't speak, who they were, what was happening in medicine at this time. And all of the people, all of the doctors, it's like watching a really phenomenal television series where all of the actors and actresses are superb. The cast of characters is interesting, and the doctors in their fields were quite progressive and top-notch.
What happened was Cleveland's personal physician was a guy named Joseph Bryant, and he was a doctor in New York. And he examined this bump on the roof of Cleveland's mouth in June of 1893, and Bryant had some expertise in oral cancers and recognized right away that this bump on the roof of Cleveland's mouth was a cancerous tumor. And so Bryant, it was Cleveland who came up with the idea of doing the operation on a friend's yacht. Cleveland had a friend named Benedict. Elias Benedict was his name. He was a banker, kind of a tycoon. And Cleveland often went on fishing trips on this yacht. And so Cleveland came up with the idea, well, we'll just keep it secret. We'll do the operation on this yacht. And it was Bryant, his personal physician, who then recruited the rest of the surgical team. And he recruited five doctors. And you're right, this was like a dream team of American surgery in the 1890s. One of the guys was a guy from Philadelphia named Keene, William Williams Keene, and he performed the first successful removal of a brain tumor in the U.S. Hasbrook was the name of the dentist who was recruited, and dentists at that time were anesthesiologists, and he was really the most respected anesthesiologist in the country at the time. And so they recruited this dream team of doctors to do this operation. And as I said, it's amazing that they agreed to do it because they were really risking their careers, their livelihoods, by agreeing to do this operation on a moving boat.
Oh, my gosh.
And it was really cool to learn some of the different little terms and the little things you learn. But I love the expression in the 1890s at that time. The expression was, if anything went wrong, they'd all be up to the hub in mud. And they really would have been up to the hub in mud if anything had gone wrong.
Yeah. Let's give the phone number. People who are listening are certainly welcome to join this conversation. I would hope that some of you, the book's been out a little while, not very long, would have had a chance to read this fascinating story, or you might be experts on Grover Cleveland or the medical team who attended to him or the Gilded Age. Our guest is the author of The President is a Sick Man, and our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Matthew Algio is joining us by phone from, it just sort of fits with everything he does, Mongolia. He's a public radio reporter. He's also the author of Harry Truman's excellent adventure, The True Story of a Great American Road Trip. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Matthew Algio, our guest, our phone number. If you'd like to join, I can understand how you're just hearing the story because maybe you haven't heard the story before. I certainly hadn't. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Let's go back to the boat and describe that scene, if you would, Matthew, and what the doctors were worried about, the form of keeping the pain under control that was used, because all of that was new at this time as well.
Yeah. Another one of the cool things about researching it was kind of learning about the state of medicine at that time. And we're really kind of in between. We're really just coming out of medieval medicine into modern medicine. I mean, the whole germ theory of disease is just beginning to be accepted. And the doctors at that time were, as we mentioned earlier, really the cream of the crop. And so they were kind of on the cutting edge of technology. So they did accept the germ theory of disease. And one of the doctors who helped perform the operation, he actually lived until the 1950s. And he would look back on it kind of nostalgically, this operation, and he would say, well, at least we boiled our instruments. So they did boil the instruments at least. And they prepared a room below deck on this yacht. The yacht was called the Oneida, and it was really a luxury yacht. It was one of the great yachts of the Gilded Age. But what they did is they turned one of the rooms below deck, a saloon, into a operating theater. And there was no operating table. They actually had a chair that they lashed to a mast that was in the center of the room, and that's where they operated on the president. They washed down the room, and they had a small portable battery connected to an electric light bulb, and that was the only light. And so they all gathered on the yacht. It was the night of June 30th, 1893, and the doctors were all brought to the yacht under cover of darkness so nobody would recognize them. Cleveland came to the yacht later that night, and the next morning they sailed from New York to Cleveland's summer home on Cape Cod. And while they were in Long Island Sound, they were cruising across Long Island Sound. That's where the operation was performed. It lasted about 90 minutes. And they anesthetized the president with a combination of nitrous oxide, laughing gas, and ether. And during those 90 minutes, they removed this tumor that was on the roof of his mouth. It was on the upper left-hand side of the roof of his mouth. And they took out the tumor along with five teeth, a lot of the upper palate, and a good piece of the upper left jawbone as well. And so it was fairly radical surgery at the time. But really, that was the only treatment for cancer at that time, was to remove the tumor as completely as they could. And so he really received the most appropriate treatment for that time. And after about 90 minutes, the operation was done. They packed the wound with some gauze, and they kind of just sailed around Long Island Sound and Buzzards Bay for 4 days until Cleveland was well enough to get off the boat at his summer home. And 4 days later, he got off the boat in Massachusetts, and that was it for the operation.
And we're talking about a part of the body where you could obviously see that something had been done. The chances that he may have had to lose his distinguishable mustache,
right.
The possibility that maybe he would lose some of the eye motion. He could have been out of this looking like a wreck.
So much really fell in Cleveland's favor. For one thing, they could do the operation completely inside the mouth. They didn't have to make an external incision, so there was no external scar. As you mentioned, he had this very distinctive, the bushy mustache. That's one of the things people remember about Cleveland. And they were able to spare that. They didn't have to shave that at all. And so when they dropped him off at his summer home on Cape Cod, after a couple weeks, they had a dentist come up and fit him with a prosthetic device. Really was like a piece of vulcanized rubber, like a hockey puck, that he could pop up into that space, the hole in his mouth, basically. And this restored the shape of his face. And it also restored his speaking voice, which was most important. And when he had this prosthetic device in his mouth, his face had the normal shape. He had his normal speaking voice, and it really made the cover-up complete. Nobody knew anything had happened. Really, within 3 or 4 weeks after the operation, he was out fishing on Buzzards Bay, and he was giving speeches and talking, and nobody knew anything had happened. I mean, there were so many places along this story that things could have gone wrong for Cleveland, but everything just worked out perfectly for him in terms of maintaining this cover-up, and they were able to do the operation inside the mouth. Didn't have to shave his mustache. And once he was fitted with this device, nobody really knew that anything had happened. Mm-hmm.
Switch to the story now of E.J. Edwards, who's also a fascinating character. Obviously, the press is wondering, where the heck is the president? He's on a long fishing trip. They're waiting for him to get off the boat, et cetera. But one of the people on the boat talks, spills the beans.
What happened was, basically, we talked earlier about Cleveland and his reputation for honesty. And what happened was, when suspicions were aroused that something was wrong with him, Cleveland's cover story was dentistry. They said that he had suffered a toothache, that he had had a tooth extracted, which was true.
Right.
The other four teeth, the palate, the jawbone, the tumor.
Right.
So this was the cover story, was that they had had that he had a tooth extracted. What happened, though, about 2 months after the operation, we're now in late August of 1893, Elijah J. Edwards, E.J. Edwards, he was a reporter for a newspaper called the Philadelphia Press, and he was based in New York. And he had heard rumors that Cleveland had had some major surgery while he was on the boat. And Edwards was able to track down the source of those rumors. And it was a guy named Hasbrook, who was the dentist / anesthesiologist on the boat. And what happened was, Hasbrook, the dentist, had missed a very important appointment because he was stuck on the boat for a couple days. And so when he finally got to the doctor who he had the appointment with, he explained himself by saying, well, as it happens, I was operating on President Cleveland. And so this probably got him off the hook with the doctor.
Right.
But this is how the first word started to spread, especially among doctors in New York, that something was seriously wrong with the president. And Edwards, the reporter, had a doctor friend who had heard these rumors and told them to Edwards. And Edwards went to Hasbrook and got Hasbrook to basically confirm the story. And so Edwards, on August 29th, 1893, he published a report in the Philadelphia Press. The headline was, "The President, a Very Sick Man." And it really was a story that completely told what had happened on the yacht. It explained about the operation and that Cleveland had had cancer and that the tumor had been removed. It identified the doctors. It was really it was one of the great scoops in the history of American journalism. But the only problem was Cleveland denied it. And Cleveland had built this reputation for honesty, and the public believed the president. Again, one of those things that probably wouldn't happen today, the president getting the benefit of the doubt like that. But Cleveland did get the benefit of the doubt in 1893, and the public believed Cleveland that he had nothing more than a toothache, and Edwards was really pretty thoroughly discredited.
And partially they believed it because other newspapers that had ties to Cleveland and were politically more in his favor. I mean, it's a pretty straightforward account. You include it in the book, and the story is, it looks like a reputable paper, and there's nothing sensational about the whole thing. It's straightforward, but other people are trying to discredit this obviously very accomplished reporter because of their ties to certain kinds of politics or to the administration. Is that fair to say?
Yes, exactly. One of the things that was fascinating for me to study was this period in American journalism where, almost like medicine, is kind of moving into a new modern era, journalism is too. Journalism is beginning to kind of move out of this straight partisan, partisan journalism that was really, you know, the hallmark of early American journalism. I mean, papers were either Republican, they were Democratic, they were Whig, whatever. Papers didn't make any bones, newspapers didn't make any bones about it. I mean, we still have papers called the Democrat or the Republican. But it really, in the 1890s, you begin to see the development of what we consider modern, independent, objective journalism. And Edwards, the reporter who found out about this operation, was kind of on the cutting edge of that. He had worked with Jacob Riis, who did How the Other Half Live, an investigative series in New York about life in the tenements. And so Edwards really was kind of one of the first American investigative journalists, kind of as we would know them today. But you still see there were a lot of newspapers that were straight partisan newspapers. And so the Democratic papers, when this story came out, and Edwards happened to work for a Republican, nominally Republican paper, the Philadelphia Press, but when the Democratic papers got wind of this story, they just jumped all over Edwards. They vilified him. I mean, there were terrible cartoons on the front page of newspapers that made him look like the organ grinder for the Republican Party. He was called a disgrace to journalism, a cancer faker, a panic monger, all these sorts of things. The Democratic papers really vilified Edwards. And it was an interesting time in American journalism. I mean, you see Pulitzer has gone into New York to really invent modern yellow journalism, as we would call it today. Hearst is about to move into New York. So it reminds me really of the cable TV wars that we have today, the news channels with MSNBC and Fox and CNN. I mean, there were, I forget how many newspapers there were. In Philadelphia alone, I think there were 14 daily newspapers.
Isn't that something?
30. And so it was a golden age of American newspapers. And it really was not unlike American journalism today in terms of, you see, the Internet and bloggers and as I said, cable TV news. It was a little bit like that.
It's hard to believe that, well, it isn't hard to believe considering the powers that be here, but it's amazing that this guy, E.J. Edwards, is such a thorough reporter, such a highly educated, so well thought of, considered one of the best reporters of his day. And obviously he was because he got this story and his story was picked up by other newspapers all over the country. I mean, it's a case, it's kind of sad that somebody can be destroyed that way for telling the truth and for being such an upstanding reporter.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned his, he really was a well-educated man. He actually had a law degree from Yale. And this is one of the things that some of the other reporters who turned against him really resented. You're just beginning to see at this time in American journalism, American newspapers specifically, that it's becoming much more professionalized. And there was the old school in the 1890s, old school reporters who never really graduated from high school. They sort of went into newspapers as a trade. And you're just beginning to see the beginning, the emergence of kind of the professional journalist, the professional person who, you know, goes to college, studies journalism. And Edwards kind of represented that, the new wave of American newspaper reporters. And that's one of the reasons I think people, other newspapers kind of really attacked him in a way, because they resented him. He represented the new kind of American newspaper reporter, and especially the old guard, they resented that. They didn't like these fancy pants college boys coming in and taking their jobs and telling them what to do. And that's what Edwards was. I mean, he was a Yale guy from Connecticut, and I think a lot of his peers resented him for that.
We're talking this hour of the program with the author of a totally fascinating book, The President is a Sick Man, wherein the supposedly virtuous Grover Cleveland survives a secret surgery at sea and vilifies the courageous newspaper man who dared expose the truth. Matthew Algio does pick very interesting times in American history and carries on with great books about that time in history. He's also author most recently of Harry Truman's Excellent Adventure, The True Story of the Great American Road Trip. He's a public radio reporter and is joining us by phone from Mongolia, which is where he lives. Well, if you'd like to join the conversation, feel free to do so. If not, just listen along, because I'm sure many of you are finding it as riveting as I am. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. We also have an email that's come in. We'll go to that momentarily. That address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Matthew Algio is our guest. Before we go to phone calls, Matthew, there's so much in this book, I just feel as though we need hours to talk about it. Another reason that you write about in the book that the cover-up was successful here is that there were huge tragedies taking place in America simultaneously, natural disasters. Can you talk about those?
Yeah, Cleveland had the good fortune, is not the best way to put it, I guess, but the luck anyway of having some big things going on in the country. So when the story broke that he had this cancer, when E.J. Edwards, the reporter, broke the story that Cleveland had been operated on for cancer on the yacht, it was exactly that day that a tornado slammed into the southeast in Georgia and South Carolina, and something that thousands of people were killed in this tornado. It was one of the great natural disasters really in American history. I think it's still the second or third deadliest tornado in American history. And so when this tornado hit, it really swept all these questions about Cleveland's health off the front pages. It kind of put an end to the debate, because there were bigger things to worry about, and the country, as we talked at the top of the show, was in the grips of this great economic crisis, and that in combination with this natural disaster really ended any speculation about Cleveland's health. It was as if the papers had bigger things to worry about. There was something else that happened, too. Cleveland's wife, we talked about how young she was when they were married in 1886 during his first term. Well, she was pregnant with their second child, and that child was born shortly after these reports about Cleveland's operation came out. It was actually the only child, or the only child of a president to actually be born within the White House itself. Esther was her name, Esther Cleveland. And so the birth of Esther, combined with these other events going on at the time, really kind of put to rest any questions about Cleveland's health.
Right. Strong enough, healthy enough to have a baby, right?
Making babies.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think, too, this is where we have to, I always have to do the little aside right here about baby Ruth. Ruth was the Cleveland's first child. She was born actually between his two terms as president, but she was a huge sensation. The birth of baby Ruth was a huge sensation, and many years later, it was in 1921, a candy company put out a candy bar called Baby Ruth, and they claimed it was named after this the child of Grover Cleveland, but it turned out that it actually came out the same year Babe Ruth, the baseball player, broke onto the scene and became a huge national hero. So I find it hard to believe that the candy bar is named after baby Ruth, Grover Cleveland's daughter. But that's what the story for the candy company is anyway.
Here's an email that's come in from Karen. While listening to today's program, I Googled Grover Cleveland and found a recent book which detailed the scandal of his out-of-wedlock child. The book seemed to indicate that he raped the mother of the boy, took the boy from the mom, who was eventually institutionalized. The scandal was likened to John Edwards.
Yeah, there is another book out right now. What are the odds of there being two Grover Cleveland?
Pretty great.
It's the summer of Grover Cleveland. And I have to be honest, I haven't read the other book. But I guess it does make some pretty spectacular claims about this. I've never heard of this, that Cleveland raped the woman, the mother of this child. And I don't know how you would prove something like that 130 years after the fact, the thing with Grover that's interesting is that people talk about Barack Obama, President Obama, that people say, we don't know where he came from, we don't know anything about his background. Well, Grover Cleveland was exactly like that. I mean, this guy, as we mentioned earlier, went from zero to the president in 4 years. Nobody had ever heard of him, and we really don't know a lot about Grover Cleveland's early life. I mean, he's in his mid-40s when he's elected to the presidency, but really up until that time, he's just a bachelor living in Buffalo. And so his background really is this blank slate that you can kind of draw anything you want on, because you really don't know. So he's a fascinating character like that. There's a lot of mystery to Grover Cleveland.
Dan is our caller from on the road somewhere. Hi, Dan.
Hi. I just tuned in to your program, and the first couple things that I heard were about the reporter Edwards being vilified. And what came to mind is it's not unusual. There was the reporter who did the story on the trafficking in order to support the Contras. believe he worked for the San Jose Mercury News. And he, well, much like Edwards, but I think, I don't know if Edwards, I don't know the history of him, but I don't know if he has come to the same pressures and as, I think it was Gary, like Gary Larson or Gary Olson for, was the reporter's name. But he ended up being ostracized and pretty much shut down by the powers at hand.
Let's carry on with the story of E.J. Edwards. What happened to him?
Well, Edwards' career suffered as a result of this. I mean, the policy, and I have a quote, a letter from Grover Cleveland in the book, that the policy was not just to deny Edwards' report, but to discredit him. And as we talked about before, the Democratic newspapers, rival newspapers, really piled on Edwards. And this was a cloud that hung over his career for the rest of his career, really. He bounced from paper to paper, and I don't want to say that his career was ruined, but it was really something that hung over his career. And it would take a long time, but he was finally vindicated many years later. When one of the doctors who had taken part of this in the operation on Cleveland, Keene from Philadelphia, who we mentioned earlier, and Keene had always felt badly about the way Edwards had been maligned, had been mistreated. And so in 1917, this is now 24 years after the operation, and after Cleveland had already died, Grover Cleveland, by the way, he lived 15 years after this surgery with no known recurrence of cancer, so it was really an amazing achievement in American medical history, American surgical history, but nobody knew about it until 1917 when one of the doctors finally told the story in the Saturday Evening Post, of all places. But one of the reasons the doctor, Keene, decided to tell the story was to vindicate Edwards, the reporter, to vindicate him, as Keene said, as a truthful correspondent. And so it was in 1917 that the truth finally came out, and E.J. Edwards was still alive at that time. He was an old man. At that time, but he was very gratified that Keene chose to publish this information. Keene actually, before publishing the report, asked permission from Grover Cleveland's widow, Frances, who we mentioned was a young, much younger woman than Grover. She was still alive at the time. And Frances, to her credit, agreed that the story should be published, and so it was in 1917.
I love the vision of Edwards going to the mailbox to get the Saturday Evening Post and going back. He wasn't real chipper at that point in his life, but yeah, going back and sitting down and reading the story when he was 71 years old.
Yeah, it was, and it's. I also like the idea that Frances Cleveland, who was Grover's widow, she actually remarried. After Grover died, she married a college professor named Thomas Preston, and was actually married to Thomas Preston longer than she was married to Grover Cleveland. Had five children with Grover, though, didn't have any children with Thomas Preston. But Frances actually lived until 1947. And I tell the story in a book that in 1947, near the end of her life, she was at a fancy dinner, and she was seated yeah, next to General Dwight Eisenhower. But her place card only identified her as Mrs. Thomas Preston, and Eisenhower had no idea who this old woman was. And they started chatting, and they started talking about Washington, and Frances said to Grover, "You know, I used to live in Washington." And Frances said to Eisenhower, "I used to live in Washington." And Eisenhower said, "Really? Where?" And it was only then that Eisenhower realized he was talking to Mrs. Grover Cleveland. So, yeah, it's interesting to see how it's really not that long ago that all this happened. To us, it just, you know, seems like ancient history, but a real quick story. I lived in Portland, Maine, and I met a woman. I went to a church there, a congregational church, and I met a woman named Margaret Cleveland. And I made a joke about Grover Cleveland, and she said, "Actually, that was my grandfather."
Oh, my goodness.
And what happened was Grover was born in 1837, and when he was 60 in 1897, he had a son named Francis. And Francis, when he was 60 in 1957, had the daughter, Margaret.
Oh, my goodness.
And so Margaret was born in 1957, but it's 120 years between her and her grandfather. So obviously she'd never met Grover. But it was just one of those, an example of how, you know, it's really not that long ago.
Right. No, it's not. And little did Eisenhower know the fascinating stories that Francis could have told him at that dinner table conversation.
Exactly. And little, you know, little did Frances know that she was sitting next to a future president at that time.
Right. Oh, my. Thanks, Dan, for the call. Mike in Milwaukee. Hi.
I just wanted to key off of your guest living in Mongolia, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, so, you know, essentially that's a part of, you know, the Republic of China right now. Can you kind of relate? China is going through what I would argue is essentially its Gilded Age with oligarchs and controlled press and the whole ball of wax. Could you kind of compare and contrast what you learned about Grover Cleveland and the environment at that time and where you're living now is going through?
I will. Well, first of all, I've only been here 2 weeks, so it's probably a little too early for me to make any pronouncements. I do want to make one minor correction. No, I'm actually Inner Mongolia is a so-called autonomous region within the People's Republic of China, but I'm actually in the Republic of Mongolia, which is an independent nation. It used to be known as Outer Mongolia between Russia and China. So I'm in Ulaanbaatar, which is the capital of Mongolia. So Mongolia is actually an independent nation, separate from Inner Mongolia, which is a Chinese province. One interesting thing here, not to get too far afield, but Mongolia has the world's fastest growing economy right now, and so it's just amazing
really?
To move to a place that I look out the window, like where I'm sitting right now, and probably there's a dozen construction cranes that you can see on the skyline. So much building is going on right now because they're sitting on huge untapped reserves of coal, copper, and gold. And China wants to get its hands on all this, and so they're pouring money into Mongolia. So it's a very interesting time and a very interesting place. And you do see here in Mongolia, in the Republic of Mongolia, which was a communist country until the early 1990s, really you're just beginning to see an independent press kind of blossoming here. So it's an interesting time in Mongolia to see that too. As a journalist myself, to be able to witness that firsthand is pretty cool.
Yeah. Oh my, you have so much going on in your life, don't you? From Grover Cleveland to Mongolia.
Yeah. I have, I'm the best-selling Grover Cleveland author in Mongolia.
That's a real claim to fame. The other thing, and we can't even do this justice, we have 2 minutes left, but the other thing that's really juicy that's part of the book is the whole railroad strike and Eugene Debs and the beginning of a progressive movement that's taking place, contrasting that with a number of Americans who are increasingly not liking Grover Cleveland.
Yeah, and you're right. It's. I wish we had more time to go into it. Suffice it to say that the Pullman strike in 1894 was really a pivotal event in American labor history, and Cleveland's reaction to it really is interesting. And I speculated in the book, and it is only speculation, that perhaps, you know, after he had this operation, I mean, a large part of his upper palate, his jaw was gone, and Cleveland sort of had a short temper to begin with, and it seems really after the operation he became a little bit more gruff and impulsive kind of in his behavior, and really his reaction to the Pullman strike, to send federal troops into Chicago to crush the Pullman strike, I think it might have had something to do with this operation that he had, that it kind of affected his judgment in some ways. I mean, there's no way to prove that, but I think it's worth pondering anyway. And there's one other thing I would mention is that and I think I talked about at the beginning, that the tumor itself was saved. The doctor saved the tumor. It was donated to a museum in Philadelphia. And for years and years and years, they wanted to do an exam on the tumor to find out exactly what kind of cancer Cleveland had. But the children, Cleveland's children, and I mentioned he had children much later in life, they wouldn't allow the cancer, the tumor to be examined because they were afraid that an examination would show that Grover had syphilis. And that would embarrass the family. And it wasn't until the late 1970s, early 1980s, that they finally allowed the tumor to be examined, and they could finally determine what kind of cancer Grover had.
Did he have syphilis?
Well, I'm not going to tell you everything.
Oh,
I mean, come on.
We didn't get to everything.
You have to buy the book to find out whether or not he had syphilis.
Oh, and I've read it. I highly recommend it.
Sorry,
I really
don't tell
do.
Anybody.
All right, I won't. But what did he die of?
He died of a very rare kind of oral cancer. It's called varicose carcinoma, or VC. And what it is, it's technically malignant, but it doesn't metastasize. But the tumor has to be removed, so he had the right treatment. If you don't remove the tumor, it just continues to grow, and eventually it can make eating and even breathing impossible. So the treatment is exactly the treatment he received. Someone who had this kind of cancer today, this VC, this kind of oral malignant oral cancer, would receive exactly the same treatment Grover did, although now they can do reconstructive bone and skin grafts, so you don't have to be fitted with a prosthetic.
But he didn't die of complications of that. Did he die of stomach cancer?
You know, we really don't know what he died of. There is speculation that he had some kind of stomach, some kind of intestinal cancer. But, you know, there was no autopsy that we know of. But there is speculation. He had some kind of stomach disorder. He died when he was 71. Mm. And some people think he might have had cancer. But if he did, it was not related to the
to the mouth.
Because the cancer he had is the mouth.
We have to go. I'm so sorry.
Okay.
It was a great time with you. Thank you. Thanks for doing the book.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Carry
on.
Enjoy it. Thank you, Matthew Algio. The book is The President is a Sick Man. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in downtown Milwaukee.